One of the confusing and difficult things about trying to understand the God who is revealed to us in the Bible is making sense of the often contradictory images and descriptions of God. How can a God who says that we are to love everybody and be merciful to everybody, because that's what God is like, be the same God who commands armies to destroy their enemies, man, woman, and child, and who is allegedly planning to cast large numbers of people into the fires of hell for eternity? One can't pretend that these conflicting images don't exist in the Bible. They do. So either some of them are wrong, or God is quite variable, and these different descriptions are each true of God in different situations or different eras. There is, in fact, a theological opinion held among many Christians who believe that every word of the Bible must be equally true, known as dispensationalism, which attempts to address the problem of these various images by arguing that time is divided into different dispensations or eras, and that God's relationship to the world is different in each dispensation. So the way that God related to the world before the fall of Adam and Eve is quite different from the way that God related between the fall and the coming of Jesus. And the way that God relates to us now is quite different from the way that God will relate at the final judgment. And thus they have a theory that can accommodate a God who is a bloodthirsty warrior on one page and a tender shepherd on another page. Well, this theory of dispensationalism, you don't have to memorise that word, there'll be no exam, but it seems to create far more problems than it solves. Apart from anything else, just think about how we regard people who keep changing their stripes. We regard them as dangerously unstable, as two-faced or untrustworthy. And look at the quandary many Essendon supporters currently find themselves in over James Hird. This was a man who was such a hero and could do no wrong in the eyes of many, but who now seems to be simultaneously accepting a massive penalty, denying that he ever did anything wrong other than failing to be adequately aware of what was going on, and deflecting any questions about what happened last year by saying, "We've moved on." Like, we're in a new dispensation now. We don't have to be held to account for what happened in the old one. Why would we be expecting to be any more convinced if God starts using that kind of defence? And when we come to today's reading from the letter to the Hebrews, we run into a major problem for the dispensationalists, because the epistle writer quite categorically says, Jesus the Christ is the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. And forever. Yesterday, today, and forever. Not like this today and like that tomorrow. Jesus is the same yesterday and today and forever. And there are certainly some wrong-headed ways of understanding this particular line too. It has been used to argue that Jesus, and therefore God, are detached and emotionless and passionless and unaffected by anything that goes on in our world, good or bad. This is clearly not supported by anything else that we know about Jesus, who is frequently described by the gospel writers as being deeply moved or grieved or knotted up with compassion or filled with joy. But it's also not the least bit necessary to make sense of this description of Jesus being unchanging, because that's equally explained by saying that the kinds of feelings and emotions and passions that Jesus has are consistent over the ages. Jesus does not go from being a gentle and compassionate healer to a grumpy and vindictive despot as he gets older. Jesus is the same yesterday and today and forever. What this line most definitely is a direct challenge to the heresy of the two-faced God. And it does have some important implications for the ways that we understand and read the Bible. When you put this line alongside the clear witness of the New Testament writers that Jesus is the ultimate revelation of God, and that, as Jesus put it himself, "If you have seen me, you have seen the Father," then we can't quarantine this line to Jesus alone. we have to conclude that it also means that God is the same yesterday and today and forever. And if Jesus is the ultimate revelation of God, then we have to read all the Bible through the revelation of Jesus, not the other way round. The Bible is not the primary revelation, but the primary witness to the revelation. And like any other witness, we accept that the testimony will have variations in its accuracy. So when we read that God in the time of Moses commanded the Israelites to commit genocide in the land of Canaan, we have to critique that through our knowledge of Jesus the Christ, who is the same yesterday and today and forever, and ask, is it possible that God could do that? Or are we, what we're seeing here, is it an accurate revelation of how people use God to justify their own evil rather than a revelation of God? Similarly, when we read the predictions that Christ will return as a conquering warrior and consign his enemies to an eternal lake of fire, we have to critique that through our knowledge of Jesus the Christ, who is the same yesterday and today and forever, and ask, is it possible that the one who prayed that his enemies might be forgiven, even as they nailed his flesh to the cross, would be secretly harbouring a desire to return and burn the lot of them? Or are we seeing there an accurate revelation of how downtrodden people can project their hunger for vindication into a violently triumphant future? Every part of the Bible can accurately reveal important truth to us, but some parts reveal the truth about God, and other parts reveal the truth about our idolatrous attempts to remake God in the image of our own interests and desires. And Jesus, who is the same yesterday and today and forever, is the key to recognising the difference. If Jesus was advocating forgiveness for his persecutors as he hung on the cross, then you can be quite sure that Jesus will be advocating forgiveness for his persecutors when he is seated on a judgment throne, because Jesus is the same yesterday and today and forever. And if Jesus made the broken and failed and outcast feel safe and loved when he was here before, then you can be sure they will feel nothing to, that there's nothing to fear from him when he comes again, because Jesus is the same. If Jesus was not telling up black marks and condemning people last time, why would we think that he would be wearing a different face next time? Do we believe that Jesus is the same yesterday and today and forever, or don't we? Now, the implications of this do not stop with our understandings of the Bible and whether or not we need to fear the coming Christ. It's important to note that this line from the letter to the Hebrews comes at the climax of some ethical teaching. Let mutual love continue. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers. Remember those who are in prison. Let the marriage bed be kept undefiled. Keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have. So part of what the writer is asserting is saying, when he says that Jesus is the same yesterday, today and forever, is that these ethical teachings are not just relative to passing cultural expectations, but that they are rather more unchanging than that. But we also need to recognise that that does not lead to a kind of blind conservatism that simply says that the way we understood values yesterday needs to be preserved for all time. Jesus himself was constantly challenging the ethical understandings of his age, and he was being constantly accused of being too revisionist, not too conservative. So when this passage says, for example, let marriage be held in honour by all, a simple conservative response says, we can't change our understanding of marriage, and therefore everybody should vote next week for the candidate who will defend a traditional understanding of marriage. But an alternative response will acknowledge that Jesus critiqued the understandings of marriage in his day, and there's therefore no reason to think that he wouldn't do the same in our day, and that marriage practices in our day bear very little resemblance to those in the past anyway. And that this instruction to honour marriage is a sub-point under the heading, let mutual love continue. There can be no doubt that Jesus' commitment to letting mutual love continue is the same yesterday and today and forever. But there's also no doubt that the implications of that will vary as the threats to mutual love vary over time. Surely, too, we must take note of what Jesus is saying in the gospel reading that we heard tonight, because far too often our wrangling over theological truths and ethical correctness is just another form of jostling for the places of honour at the banqueting table of our Lord. Everybody wants to be in the right place, to be honoured by the Lord of the feast for having firmly held to the expected standards or proven ourselves more worthy than those who have fallen into error or ill discipline. And it happens in our politics as well as in our theological posturing. The stop the boat slogans are little more than another expression of the jostling for positions of honour, because they are premised on the assumption that there's a descending scale of seats of honour at the table of our nation's resources, and that those who were born here should have the best seats, and those who came here through the approved channels should have the next most sought-after seats, and those who are impoverished and traumatised and desperate and came some other way are once again sent to the bottom of the table or kicked off the table completely. But the Christ, who is the same yesterday and today and forever, tells us to do as our Father in heaven does and invite the poor and the crippled and the lame and the blind and the traumatised and the displaced to our banquet. And that the only way that we are likely to lead to any greater honour for ourselves is to throw our efforts into trying to secure places of honour for those who might otherwise be denied them. Which is not going to help solve anybody's voting dilemmas very much, because both of the major parties jostling for positions of honour on your ballot papers seem to be equally obnoxious in their treatments of exactly the people that Jesus told us to put first on our invitation lists. But perhaps it will remind us that whatever the electoral outcome next Saturday, Jesus will remain very little interested in the outcomes of political games of winners and losers, but intensely interested in ensuring that mutual love continues and that those in desperate need are offered compassion and generous hospitality at our tables. Little projects like that World Vision project that we're trying to get involved in to enable us to invite asylum seekers into our homes for meals are not in themselves going to change the world. But what they will do when we grab such opportunities is open the door to enable us to glimpse and taste the new world. And what they will do is give us a chance to live in simple, practical ways the simple, practical things that Jesus asks us to do right here in these words tonight. The time for taking such a call seriously is not some previous dispensation, nor some future era when we'll be in a better position. The time to live out the love and compassion and humble hospitality of Jesus is always now, for Jesus is the same yesterday and today and forever.